Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's COVID-19 and State Medicaid Budgets call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have an opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note, this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Rachel Newsom.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, how short-term cuts could result in long-term harm to children and families, especially in communities of color. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. Today's call is in partnership with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. We'll be focusing on the enhanced risk of cutting Medicaid for children, pregnant people, and the providers that serve them during COVID-19, and referencing a newly released brief on this topic that you can find on the teleconference page on our site. The COVID-19 pandemic has magnified the longstanding racial, ethnic, and economic disparities in our nation, with the disease burden, mortality rate, and economic impact being felt more acutely by our most vulnerable, including our children. As the pandemic continues to reach record high levels across the country, the well-being of our nation's youth is at risk. A survey fielded this fall found that an additional 2.5 million children were in poverty since May due to COVID-19. As of September, that was roughly 20% of all children in the United States. Educational attainment, juvenile justice, earning potential, deferred necessary physical and mental health services all are impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, and importantly, all can be positively impacted by guaranteeing access to stable and consistent coverage for kids and families via Medicaid. At the same time, state budgets are under pressure from decreased tax revenues and continuing costs of battling the pandemic. As the second largest expenditure for states, it's easy to understand why Medicaid may be looked to for budget savings. However, as we'll hear from our panelists, policymakers should tread carefully, understanding the full fiscal impact of Medicaid reductions on both the health of their populations and their budgets. It's now more important than ever that health coverage is protected for the millions of children nationwide who rely on Medicaid, many of whom are children of color and have already been disproportionately affected by the crisis. Our panelists today will discuss newly released research on the long-term benefits of Medicaid coverage for children and families, as well as Medicaid's return on investment for state and federal government, the broader societal returns, and the far-reaching implications of cutting Medicaid for children and birthing people during a global pandemic. The pandemic has touched every corner of our healthcare system, but we only have 45 minutes today, so we'll be focused very specifically on the impact of Medicaid budget cuts on children and families. All the resources from our discussion today and from earlier teleconferences can be found at the Fund's COVID-19 resource page on our website. I'm joined today by experts Joan Alker, Executive Director and Research Professor of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, Myra Alvarez, President of the Children's Partnership, Dr. Melinda Williams-Willingham, Chair of the Committee on Federal Government Affairs at the American Academy of Pediatrics, and Dr. Lori Zephrin, Vice President of Delivery System Reform at the Commonwealth Fund. We're thrilled that the four of you are able to join us today. Thank you for all that you're doing. And with that, I will turn it over to Joan.
Thanks so much, Rachel. Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us here today. I want to start out by thanking the Commonwealth Fund for the support of this research and also to thank my Georgetown CCS co-authors of the paper, Edwin Perk and Alexander Corcoran. As we gather here today, we're all aware that families with children are facing an extraordinary set of daunting challenges, a deepening historic and deadly pandemic, millions of people who've lost their jobs and in some cases their health insurance, school closures and declines in utilization of regular sources of pediatric care. These new challenges are exacerbated by the distinctly not new challenge of systemic racism and racial disparities that are worsening the consequences of the pandemic for communities of color. Even prior to the pandemic, more children...
Yes. Joan, I'm so sorry to interrupt. It's a little bit hard to hear you, and I wanted to see if you could move a little bit closer to the speaker so we don't miss the findings. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay, that's okay. Is that better?
That is. Thank you so much.
Is that
Go ahead.
Rachel? Yeah, okay. Even prior to the pandemic, more children were becoming uninsured over the past few years, a reversal of historic progress that was made over many decades. This trend has surely gotten worse in 2020. My colleagues on the panel will discuss many of the challenges that children are facing today, so let me turn now to the contents of the paper. A quick level setting, Medicaid's role for children has grown over time, and today Medicaid is the single largest insurer of children, covering 39% of children nationwide. While the majority of children on Medicaid are white, children of color are disproportionately represented among Medicaid beneficiaries. The objective of the paper was to review and summarize the multitude of studies that have been published in the past couple of years, mostly in peer-reviewed journals, and these studies examine the long-term impact of Medicaid exposure on children and pregnant women. While the importance of having health insurance in the short term is relatively well known, the value of providing Medicaid coverage for children as they become adults is less well known and has really only become apparent over time. As a consequence of multiple federal law changes, Medicaid and CHIP expansions were phased in over decades by states in a different ways, creating a rich opportunity for researchers today to look at what impact these public coverage changes have had on kids, in effect prompting a multitude of where are they now examinations of a wide range of outcomes for children who newly had Medicaid as it was being expanded and are now adults. So what do these studies find? Well, we hope you will read the paper. It's not long, but it has many findings cited. But in short, having access to Medicaid as a child results in a wide range of long-term benefits, including better long-term health outcomes, higher educational attainment, such as improvement in high school graduation rates and college attendance, improved earnings, reduced use of government programs as adults, and even lower mortality as these children reach adulthood. Here are a few specific examples. There are multiple studies looking at the long-term health impact. I'll just mention a few. Medicaid coverage in early life is associated with a decreased incidence of chronic conditions in adults aged 19 to 36, as measured by an index of conditions that included diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and obesity. In related findings, multiple studies find declines in hospitalizations and emergency room visits as adults who had exposure to Medicaid as children. One study found that more years of childhood eligibility for Black children in particular led to decreased hospitalizations at age 25. And multiple studies find reductions in mortality for young adults and all the way up to age 40. Early childhood Medicaid coverage under age 12 was associated with lower application rates for Social Security disability insurance among adults aged 25 to 64, and in a separate study, a decline in rates of application for supplemental security income for applicants aged 20 to 28. In fact, investing in children's health is really one of the smartest investments government can make. With increased earnings as a consequence of having Medicaid, particularly noticeable for girls and young women, that resulted in higher earnings, more taxes paid, and fewer benefits accessed as adults, such as the disability programs I mentioned and the earned income tax credit. In fact, according to one study published this past summer, government recoups its investment in childhood Medicaid already by the time the eligible children reach age 36. Unfortunately, though, looking at the long-term outcomes is often not the way our political discussions go. As we discuss these findings today, we know that Medicaid is at great risk of cuts in upcoming state budget sessions, especially in light of federal inaction that we see that is not providing additional support to states. And this leads me to the final aspect of the paper that I wanted to highlight for you today. Because Medicaid is a federal-state matching program, states that make cuts in state dollars see a distinctly larger multiplier effect of these cuts to their Medicaid program and their healthcare economy. This is especially true now as the federal matching rate is enhanced by 6.2 percentage points due to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. So what this multiplier means is that for states like California or New York, which have relatively lower federal matching rates, a $1 cut in state Medicaid funding results in an overall loss with the loss of federal funds of $2.28 to the state's Medicaid program and its healthcare economy. In a state like Mississippi that has the highest federal matching rate, a $1 cut in state Medicaid expenditures will result in a total loss of $6.23 to Mississippi's Medicaid program and their healthcare system.
The paper includes an appendix table with all states and their multiplier effect at the current enhanced matching rate. I'm going to conclude by saying the obvious. At a time when Medicaid is an essential first responder to the pandemic and children, especially those living in communities of color, are facing numerous and unprecedented challenges, undermining access to Medicaid by cutting the program would have extraordinarily damaging short and long-term consequences for these children and their families and our society at large. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Rachel.
Thank you so much, Joan. That was terrific. Now I'm going to turn it over to Myra Alvarez from the Children's Partnership. Go ahead, Myra.
Thank you, Rachel. Hopefully you can hear me okay and there's not any technical difficulties. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to join you today. My name is Myra Alvarez, and I am president of the Children's Partnership. We're a California policy and advocacy organization focused on child health and well-being. In following Joan's comments, I want to remind us that today American families are facing a confluence of multiple crises. Of course, the pandemic, COVID-19, and the many challenges that that imposes on families, a difficult economy, but also a national reckoning on racial injustice. And across the board, it is Black, Latinx, and communities of color more broadly that continue to bear the brunt of this pandemic and its devastating consequences, but also simultaneously shoulder the frontline work that has kept our country's economy running. And it is those families that have children, families of color with children, that are being hit the hardest. In addition to an increased risk of disease and illness that's led to an almost 80% of child COVID deaths nationwide in children of color, COVID-19 has led to changes in schooling, health services delivery, and other disruptions of normal routines that will likely affect children's health and well-being, regardless of whether they are infected directly or not. The pandemic has transformed the lives of children at critical stages of development and education, and it's particularly true for children of color, given the disproportionate impact of the virus on their families and their communities. Across the country, children of color are currently facing substantial access barriers, emotional strain, and financial hardship that could have long-term repercussions for their lives. What we need are policies that ensure access to needed health services, particularly behavioral and mental health services, as well as facilitate access to social services that support families with children and can help address some of the consequences that many families are currently facing. This is where we highlight, in particular, the importance of Medicaid for all children, but particularly children of color. Although the majority of children enrolled in the Medicaid program nationwide are white, Black, Latino, and American Indian and Alaska Native children disproportionately receive their health coverage through Medicaid. Nationally, more than half of children who identify as American Indian or Alaska Native, Black, other or multiracial, or Latinx rely on Medicaid as their source of health insurance. And yet in many states, the numbers are even more pronounced. For example, in my state of California, where we're located, 3 out of 4 children enrolled in Medi-Cal, our state Medicaid and CHIP program, are children of color. Joan shared the multiple long-term benefits that exist for children enrolled in Medicaid today and what that means for their lives when they become adults. But I want to highlight just a couple that are particularly important for children of color. When we think about the Medicaid program, we can look to the future of extending the life of our young people today. the years of Medicaid eligibility in childhood lowered mortality rates from internal causes like cancer, nervous system diseases, and infection diseases among Black adolescents in particular. In addition, children's eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP was linked to a decrease in the high school dropout rate, particularly among children of color. So as we all consider how can we close the gaps on health inequities for children of color, programs like Medicaid provide an opportunity to assess and address the health inequalities that exist for low-income children. But it means that we have work to do during an already challenging time for all. These are very difficult times for families trying to make ends meet while also staying safe and taking care of their children. And as Joan mentioned, it's also challenging for states as they continue to face an uncertain future given the many unknowns ahead of us. But as nearly all states are required to balance their budget, policymakers are considering, we expect them to consider cuts to the Medicaid programs to address these large shortfalls in revenue and budget deficits that result from the current crises that we are facing. But given the disproportionate share of children of color relying on Medicaid, Medicaid cuts in particular harm communities of color, and again, both in the short term as well as the long term. Without additional financial support and relief for states, the adverse effects of the Medicaid cuts on a state's economy will deepen and prolong the COVID-19 related recession, leading to bigger state budgets for a longer period. But the damage is not only going to be to the economy, but to the well-being of children and the long-term impacts of what an unhealthy child population means. As we've heard today, impacts on the health, disability, education, and financial security of children today and as they grow into adults of the future. So as we look to the future in our shared path toward recovery from this pandemic, we hope policymakers will consider Medicaid not merely an expense, but truly an investment in the long-term security of our children of color, a rapidly growing population, and all of us. Because if we're ever going to impact healthcare costs meaningfully, we need to stop filling up our generational pipeline with adults who have multiple chronic conditions rooted in inadequate access to nutritious food, stable housing, safe neighborhoods, quality education, and healthcare during their childhood. Given the long-term benefits of investments in Medicaid coverage, we hope policy options could further improve Medicaid for children and women and expand access to needed care. And at the federal level, that could involve any number of things, thinking about automatic Medicaid enrollment of newborns so no child leaves the hospital without coverage, elimination of eligibility restrictions based on citizenship status, streamlining enrollment with other programs like WIC and SNAP, recognizing that families are facing multiple challenges at the same time, and finding ways to address the social determinants of health that are so impactful to kids' well-being, as well as their success in school and beyond. Such reforms would likely result in further enhancements of children's long-term outcomes, but it could also improve health outcomes and reduce racial disparities in many areas, including maternal and infant health, where we know the disparities between Black women and white women are so pronounced. We have long known the old saying to be true, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As we look to rebuild our communities, Medicaid will serve as a critical source for prevention, for keeping children healthy, for supporting families with their well-being and ability to cope during this crisis. Thank you. I'll hand it back over to Rachel.
Thank you so much, Myra. As a reminder to all the attendees, we will be taking questions after all of the remarks are finished, but you can enter the queue now for questions by pressing star one. Thank you. Thank you again to Myra and to Joan. We're going to turn now to Dr. Willingham from the American Academy of Pediatrics to discuss the impact of Medicaid on child health outcomes, as well as how the Medicaid program is impacting providers. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Willingham.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dr. Melinda Williams Willingham, and I am a practicing pediatrician in Clarkston, Georgia. I am also a chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Federal Government Affairs. Working with children every day, I can tell you firsthand about the importance of Medicaid for my own patients and millions of children across the country. Right now, the stakes could not be higher for children. By mid-November, more than 1 million children had been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the United States. The pandemic has disrupted children's lives at critical stages of development, and we still don't know the long-term impacts on children's health. I've witnessed the harmful consequences of the pandemic in my own patients. Families are under significant stress, from financial stress to food insecurity, and that impacts children's physical and mental health. Among my own patients, children and adolescents I've cared for are experiencing suicidal ideation, social isolation, and depression, pointing to the ongoing pandemic as a reason for what they're feeling. Medicaid supports 67% of the children my practice cares for and has been essential during the pandemic. Thanks to Medicaid, my patients know they can rely on the trusted relationship with me and my colleagues within their pediatric medical home, and that they can get the care they need. Medicaid's comprehensive benefits help ensure that when I see a child experiencing suicidal ideation, I can connect them to a specialist for treatment without worrying that their family will have to choose between the care their child needs and paying their rent. Medicaid works for children. It is specifically designed to promote children's health and development, from vaccinations and developmental screenings to treatment for acute and chronic conditions. Any cuts to the program would disproportionately impact children. The pandemic has also had serious implications for pediatric practices. Many practices have experienced significant financial distress, facing furloughs, layoffs, and even permanent closures. As mentioned previously, my practice supports over 67% of children that rely on Medicaid, and we have three different locations with our practice. And during the pandemic, we were forced to actually have to close one location for approximately 2 to 3 months due to the financial distress. And of course, this was quite concerning because we want to make sure that children have access to care. So while pediatric practices are still struggling to keep their doors open for their patients, cuts to Medicaid would be devastating. If practices have to reduce hours or even permanently close, children will feel the impact. We know that fewer Medicaid providers means children will face barriers to accessing health care. It means families could be forced to travel far distances or face long wait times for an appointment. Children's health cannot be put on pause as we combat the pandemic. When children do not access timely health care, it can have serious consequences on their lifelong health. A delayed screening could mean delayed treatment of a serious health condition or a missed diagnosis. Missed vaccinations could put communities at risk for dangerous outbreaks of preventable diseases. Cuts to Medicaid would be devastating for the children and families who rely on it. Children must be able to access the care they need when they need it. Medicaid is a lifeline program that makes that possible. We must keep the program strong. Thank you so much, and I will turn it back over to you, Rachel.
Thank you so much. Dr. Willingham. That was terrific. And now we're going to turn to our final speaker, Dr. Lori Zephrin, who will discuss the impact of Medicaid on newborns and maternal health. So go ahead, Lori.
Great. Thanks so much, Rachel. Very excited to be a part of this distinguished panel, really discussing, you know, such an important topic. My co-panelists have really talked about the impact of Medicaid coverage in children. And the report also highlights, you know, Medicaid coverage of children and pregnant people during pregnancy and beyond is critical. So it's really about thinking of children and their families. We know that Medicaid coverage of children and pregnant people during pregnancy is associated with many long-term benefits in adulthood. Some studies finding particular benefits in Black children and other children of color. It's really shocking to think that such important investments are being jeopardized at a time now when people really need it the most, and they will need it after pregnancy. Several key points that I'd like to highlight. You know, one, covering birthing people and families helps children. You know, we can't forget the M in maternal child health, and children's positive development relies on healthy parents, healthy coverage. Health coverage improves parents' health, improves access to health care. Maternal depression, for example, has been shown to negatively impact young children's social and emotional development, as well as their long-term educational and employment opportunities. So, and more than half of infants born into poverty have a mom who's experienced some depressive symptoms. You know, it's really interesting and important to note that when Oregon extended access to Medicaid to adults, including parents, rates of depression decreased by almost a third as a result of this of new coverage. And we see now with the COVID-19 crisis, we really see the mental health impacts, but particularly the impacts on Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities disproportionately. So we know now is a time of economic stabilization, which really impacts families already. And also covering parents provides financial security for the entire family. Medical bills have historically been a major cause of bankruptcy for families. And so that coverage piece is really critical. You know, the other piece is that as parents gain health coverage, children are more likely to be covered as well. And their enrollment increases as their parents are covered. You know, the second point is we're also reckoning with a crisis of maternal mortality and morbidity in this country. And when we look at the causes of this morbidity and mortality, when this happens, about half of deaths and injury occur after birth. And when we think about Medicaid expiring 60 days after pregnancy, we really also have to think of solutions that that cover families and birthing people even beyond pregnancy. And so Medicaid extension, which is really thinking through covering moms after birth up to a year, is really critical so that the moms don't experience coverage gaps in pregnancy that can harm them and their families. Extending Medicaid coverage for low-income pregnant people up to a full year postpartum really has a potential of helping at least 200,000 people per year gain coverage during a critical window of time for new moms and children, as more than half of these deaths occur after birth, as I mentioned previously. The other important point is that Medicaid expansion is also really critical as well. And when we look at the data around Medicaid expansion, it really allowed for earlier initiation of prenatal care and allowed for care prior to pregnancy, as well as which impacted the health of moms and babies. And even also when we look at the data around Medicaid expansion, it's one of the important indicators to improve maternal and child health. And so coverage is absolutely critical. And so as we think about, you know, just now how state budgets are already constrained due to COVID-19, it's really important to ensure that we're not further jeopardizing the health of people that are most dependent during this critical time and really need those supports. Rachel, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you so much, Lori. And I just want to thank again all of our panelists for what was a fantastic overview and walk through the evidence and the research and the literature, as well as the really on-the-ground perspectives and community perspectives around how critical this issue is for children and their families. Want to remind all of the attendees to get in the queue for questions. You can press star one. I have a couple to get us started, but we will certainly do that and hear our questions come. So, Brittany, maybe we can go with Tammy first.
I'm going to open the line for Tammy Luby with CNN.
Hi, thank you for holding this call. So under Families First, I thought that states were not allowed to disenroll during or make qualifications harder during the pandemic. So can you give me some examples of, you know, states and state actions that you think may harm children and families? Like, what's happening? Is it things that might happen in the future or things that are already starting?
Go ahead, Jen. Would you like to start?
Sure. Yes. Thank you, Tammy. I'm really glad you asked that question. So as you mentioned, there is currently a disenrollment freeze in the Medicaid program as a consequence of the Families First Act. And for states that take the 6.2 percentage point increase in the match, they have to abide by this maintenance of effort, and they're not allowed to cut eligibility. That's absolutely correct. So they can't cut anybody off. However, we know that states, due to the decline in revenues, due to increases in Medicaid enrollment, which I'll get back to in a minute, and they are facing, many of them, intense budget pressures. We've seen Medicaid enrollment grow about 11%. That was as of September, since the pandemic started. Where we would expect they will cut is provider payment rates. And that's typically where states go. And particularly, as Dr. Willingham mentioned, providers, particularly those who are serving these populations, have already suffered greatly in the pandemic. And that system is going to be essential to rolling out vaccines and everything else. So I'm going to ask Dr. Willingham to jump in, but just to note that states could also cut benefits for adults, and we've seen some proposals along those lines already. But I think the main issue is cutting provider payments on a network that's extremely stressed and tends to be underpaid in the beginning anyway. So Dr. Willingham, do you want to jump in?
Yes, thank you so much for this opportunity. That would be completely devastating to providers who accept Medicaid. Initially there was approximately a 70% decline in visits with the pandemic, so that a lot of practices really struggled to keep their offices open, their doors open. So operationally, many practices had to pivot and make changes so that they can continue to take care of their staff and try their best to serve children the best that they could. So additional cuts to the Medicaid program would simply put pediatricians out of business. There really is no other way to state that. And unfortunately, that would be devastating to children. That would further diminish the access that they would have to high-quality health care.
Okay, and I'm sorry, could you just let me know, have any states actually started doing this?
Many states are starting.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, is it something that the governor can do? Is it something the state legislature has to pass? How does it happen?
Yeah. So we're just getting now to the beginning. Typically in January, state legislative sessions start and governors put their budgets out. And the legislatures act on them in the first or second quarter of 2021. That's when we expect this to happen. State fiscal years run from July 1st, typically. Mm-hmm. So right now is precisely when governors and state legislatures are beginning to put together proposals. We've heard from quite a number of states that they are contemplating Medicaid cuts. We're just starting to see, and we'll see in January, you know, the real kind of finer details of what those cuts may be. So that's the timeline we're looking at here. That's why it's so important to get this message out now. And I did want to mention one other thing, Tammy, in response to your question, which is that the disenrollment freeze is tied to the length of the public health emergency.
Right.
When that lifts, of course, we don't know when that will be. We are very worried at that point that we could lose many children and adults off of the Medicaid program. If states, particularly those who are anxious to cut their budget, if they don't have strong guidance from the federal government on how to carefully go through that process, we know we lose a lot of children and families through at renewal through red tape. And so that's going to be a critical time when that disenrollment freeze lifts that we could potentially lose hundreds of thousands of children and families off the program inappropriately.
Thank you.
And Joan, remind us that the public health emergency is scheduled to end when, as of right now, Joan?
Currently, it is scheduled to end on January 20th, an interesting date. It is a 90-day declaration, so certainly we would expect that that will be extended through April and one presumes for longer, but of course, we just don't know.
Right, right. Great. Thank you so much. Great question. Okay, I think we're ready for the next question.
And we will take our next question from Kate Lisa with the Johnson Newspaper Corporation. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. So I guess what I would like to know is we're talking about all these kinds of devastating cuts, and of course I understand how everything is connected and cuts pretty much to anything, I guess, in this topic would be devastating to a lot of different communities. So I guess my larger question is, this is when you're looking at states that have multi-billion-dollar deficits, I mean, weren't sounding like from lawmakers all year is that these cuts are inevitable. So I guess what I want to know is how are you preparing for that fallout when, you know, urging there to not be a cut is one thing, but if it's going to happen, what next?
Great question. Myra, would you want to start us off and talk about how potentially you all are working in California to keep your policymakers kind of educated and understand trade-offs?
Sure, absolutely. I think first and foremost, it's really sharing data with our policymakers about the importance of the Medicaid program and really highlighting that the Medicaid program is not only a critical lifeline for individuals with multiple chronic conditions or living with disabilities, but that it's foundational for roughly half of the children in this country, or like I said, even more in some states like California. And in particular, in thinking about the shifting demographics of our child population, it's important to consider Medicaid as a lifeline for children of color and the healthy development of children of color. We know that children of color are one of the most rapidly growing demographics of children across the country, so are children of immigrants, and they disproportionately rely on Medicaid. And it's often that those that data, that disaggregated data, isn't front and center for policymakers. So I want to emphasize that, that's one. But also the content in this report that emphasizes the long-term benefits of Medicaid, that emphasizes the connection to educational success, to long-term economic success, to the return on investment of these government programs, allows policymakers to consider investments in Medicaid from a different perspective. So part of our work is to ensure that information such as this report, the snapshots and the takeaways are shared with policymakers. So as we prepare to rebuild from COVID and try to figure out what the future is going to look like, we can prioritize where these difficult cuts are going to be and really not think about Medicaid as the top source of those cuts.
Thank you, Myra. Joan, you referenced this in your comments, but I thought maybe you might just want to kind of underline it and take this head on, the issue of the return on investment and how valuable of a message that is and can be to state policymakers. So will you just kind of walk us through again kind of how a state cut results in multiplied federal reductions as well?
Sure. Yeah, I want to make a couple points in response to that question. First of all, I think, as I just said, with respect to the timeline, you know, this is not a foregone conclusion yet, but it's something that's going to be happening over the next few months. And federal aid is absolutely critical. The federal government really has to jump in here to support states. But it is, as Rachel mentioned, and I think, you know, for all of us who work on Medicaid, we know what a complex program it is. And state legislatures have a fair amount of turnover as well, and it's always important to understand the matching structure that I mentioned. So particularly because the federal match rate is currently enhanced as a consequence of the first or second coronavirus relief package, a $1 cut in state funding in states is going to result in a much larger cut in federal funding, ranging from $1.28 in a state like New York or California to more than $5 in a state like Mississippi. So understanding, and we have a table on this in the paper, that, you know, what looks like a $1 state cut is actually a far greater loss to a state's healthcare system because of the loss of federal funds at the enhanced matching rate is critical for those budget decision makers to understand. So so there really is much at stake. And then the last point I wanted to mention is we've talked a lot about Medicaid's role for communities of color. Another aspect to this is that Medicaid is absolutely critical for rural communities. In fact, children in rural communities rely on Medicaid at higher rates than those in urban areas. And so that is another really important piece of the educational work that needs to be done.
Thanks so much, Joan.
We will take our next question from Dorothy Mills Gregg with Inside Health Policy. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi. Thank you for doing this call and talking about children's health care. You've laid out very well a lot of the issues that children will be facing in the future. I'm very curious as states are looking at the deadline to return CARES Act funding and then trying to weigh how much more money they give schools as they're reopening for PPE. How do you think, how would you like to see states and in particular federal government kind of step up and be able to provide solutions to some of the issues that you're bringing up?
Joan, would you like to start out on that one?
Sure. I'll give a quick response and hopefully others will jump in. I mean, I think we've really seen a complete absence of a federal strategy with respect to children, a real abdication of responsibility there. Starting from the fact that even before the pandemic, we had more children losing their health insurance to the multitude of challenges that we've talked about. So what we need from the federal government, in addition to more funding, is an active role in coordinating states' responses and supporting states in their responses. State and local governments certainly are on the front lines. But they need that kind of national support to respond to this crisis, and they just simply haven't had it. And when you think about state budgets, you know, the top two expenditures, the largest expenditure in state budgets is education. And the second largest is usually their Medicaid share, even though Medicaid is actually bringing in more federal dollars than anything else. So children are in the crosshairs of this lack of federal support that we're seeing, both financial and in terms of a kind of coherent national strategy. Children are bearing the brunt, and this crisis is not going to go away. States are going to face revenue challenges, not just next fiscal year, but likely the year after as well. So this is a longer-term situation that we've got to have stronger leadership on.
And Lori, you mentioned a few policy options that the federal government could consider to really strengthen the stability of coverage for pregnant women and newborns. But could you just remind us, are there specific things that the federal government could do to really make this more seamless for that population?
Yeah, no, thanks, Rachel. It's definitely, as we think about policy opportunities to improve maternal health, you know, there's, you know, we're at a time of where there's a lot of opportunity in that space and a lot of interest from a policy perspective, but at the federal level and the state level. And so, you know, I talked about extending postpartum care as a critical piece. You know, pregnant people, birthing people cycle in and out of coverage during pregnancy and beyond, and that's destabilizing to their health and healthcare as well as to their families. And so really providing opportunities so that we can decrease this Medicaid churn. Someone mentioned earlier about sort of this automatic enrollment piece for children's health. I think that's something that can be applicable for maternal health as well. And then also really thinking across the life course, like, you know, the health and care that birthing people need doesn't end at birth. And so really, or 60 days after birth, which is how current Medicaid policy is structured. And there are states that are extending this and there's federal legislation exploring this as well. And so extending Medicaid coverage up to 1 year is going to be really critical to address the postpartum coverage gap. You know, there's also opportunities around enhancing Title V funding, for example, and, you know, that the Health and Human Services just released a really exciting action plan to address maternal mortality and morbidity. And I think with the increasing focus around racial equity and maternal health equity, there's an opportunity to really have significant impact. You know, protecting, so really being able to support Medicaid expansion, which is actually different from the extension piece that I talked about. So the Medicaid extension talks about sort of really extending coverage from birth up to a year. When we talk about Medicaid expansion, there's still 12 states that haven't considered Medicaid expansion, and really, you know, thinking of ways, particularly when states are going to, you know, are having to think about their budgets, what are federal opportunities to be able to promote, support Medicaid expansion in those states that have not expanded. And I think the last piece is really some exciting maternal morbidity and mortality legislation that's bipartisan. And so really, I think there's an opportunity to advance many pieces of this legislation, which really cover and can cover and really enhance coverage and also really address the key drivers of maternal deaths and maternal morbidity that we're seeing.
Great. Thank you so much. We've got time for one or two more questions, so we'll go ahead and take the next one.
Thank you. Our next question will be from Kelly Gisgrove with the Children's Defense Ohio. Your line is now open. Kelly, your line is now open. It appears she dropped from the queue. It looks like we have no questions at this time.
Great, thank you so much. I'll ask for attendees to give them one more opportunity. If you'd like to ask a question, to press star one. I was really struck, Joan and Lori, and maybe all the panelists want to weigh in on this, on the point about, you know, when you look at state budgets and education, the K-12 education is often number one, followed by Medicaid. I think the idea that, you know, a state policymaker would have to choose between education and Medicaid and those investments, when you look at this report from the Georgetown Center for Children and Families team, we see that that's really a false choice, and the importance of kind of consistent, stable coverage via Medicaid is really critical for those educational opportunities as well as health outcomes. So again, I want to thank all of our panelists, and then I'm going to give each of you just the opportunity to leave us with a closing thought And Dr. Willingham, why don't we start with you?
Thank you so much. I think my final thoughts would just, I would like everyone to really understand what is at stake for children and their health issues, particularly during the pandemic, and also the importance of Medicaid. It is a lifeline to many children of color in particular, but to children in general. And we know that if children experience disruption in their emotional development as well as their health, it's likely that they're going to have long-term health consequences. And this is an issue that really needs to be addressed. And I look forward to hearing more from our elected leaders and from policy experts on solutions to how we can help handle the complicated issues that we have before us. But we know Medicaid is extremely important to children, and we really, it is a false choice between choosing to fund Medicaid or K through 12 education. And so the lifelong consequences are just very substantial and significant. So that's what I would like everyone to really focus on. A lot of individuals have stated that COVID-19, this pandemic, really is not impacting children, but I don't really think that they understand exactly how children are impacted. And those are the closing thoughts that I would like to leave with everyone.
Thank you so much. Myra?
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks again for the opportunity to join everyone. I just want to emphasize, you know, Medicaid really is a critical program for millions of children across the country, and again, in particular, children of color. And this time, more than any other, has really highlighted the multiple challenges that are facing children of color. Yes, COVID, yes, challenge in the economy, but also the racial injustice that has come to light in so many different ways, from the murders of unarmed Black people to the anti-immigrant rhetoric of this administration, to time and time again, leaving communities of color behind. And when we look at Medicaid as a tool for advancing racial equity, we can really move forward important actions and positive steps to ensure that our country is living up to its values, and that the fight for racial justice is really intertwined with the fight for health justice. I think more than ever, it's been brought to light that how racism is a root cause of persistent racial health inequities, challenging our children's well-being and having profound impacts on their communities. And we truly have an opportunity to muster the political will to make a difference for kids today and kids tomorrow, but frankly, for all of us, given how interconnected our future financial security and well-being is with the well-being of our kids. And hopefully we can all work together to make that happen.
Thank you, Myra. Lori?
Thanks, Rachel. I mean, just as I'd like to echo what everyone said, and just as, you know, the report highlighted, you know, children's positive development relies on healthy parents, and healthy coverage is really critical for parents and children. And so it's really, you know, it's about investment now for our future and really understanding what priorities do we have as a society. There are the realities and the budget constraints, but also there's an increasing realization of just the importance of these investments in health and the economic and social impact in the short and long term. So really, it's really going to be critical to really take into account how we invest in maternal health and in child health, because this really will impact our future. So I think it's an exciting opportunity now, just given the coalescence around many of these issues addressing racial equity and maternal health equity. And there's really a lot of opportunity to be creative to ensure that we are not jeopardizing this lifeline for many families.
Thanks, Lori. And finally, we'll turn it over to Joe.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks to everybody on the call. You know, I just want to end the call by bringing up really another crisis our country is facing that we haven't talked about today, and that's the crisis of the political divide and the difficulties that many folks have finding common ground with each other have in common assumptions about evidence. And, you know, this may be a Pollyanna kind of remark, but I really do hope that we can all to come together around the issue of children's health. We've seen over the decades extraordinary bipartisan support to ensure that children are covered, and try as a country to move forward together, to roll up our sleeves, tackle some of these urgent problems that children are facing. So that's my hope, and thank you to all of you on this call for the work that you do, and I'll hand it back to you, Rachel.
Great. Thank you once again to all of our terrific panelists. Thanks for all of our attendees for joining us today. Again, this has been recorded. It'll be available on our website on the teleconference page, along with the brief that's been referenced. If any of you had questions that we didn't get to or that came up in the last few minutes, please feel free to reach out to us by email. And as I mentioned, all the resources can be found on our website. So thank you again. Have a great rest of your day. Take care.